post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts. They'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics. Brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Joining me to sit shivering in a concrete cell with only tins of cat food for nourishment this week is Darren Scott, editor of SFX, the world's most successful sci-fi, fantasy and horror magazine. In a career spanning over 20 years, Darren has written for all manner of publications, including The Guardian and The Independent, as well as spending 10 years as editor of Gay Times, the largest, longest-running and most recognised LGBTQ+ magazine and website. A massive Doctor Who fan, Darren's also been a marvellous champion of Us at Cutaway, and articles, features and comic strips galore have graced SFX's pages, with even more to come. Darren, welcome to The Bunker.
Hello.
Hi. Great to have you here. It must always be strange having someone do a bio of you, but it's just a potted biography of your illustrious career. You've been at SFX for 3 years, haven't you? Is it 3?
No, it's actually coming up on 5.
Oh my goodness, is it? Yeah, because I think because you actually, yeah, because when we met for the first time at the BFI the other day, you were saying, yeah, you were already in post when COVID struck, weren't you?
Yes, so
and then I had to contend with all that.
Yeah, so I had been, I think it was the previous May. So things were starting, you know, because you don't want to change things too much when you join a publication that's been going on for as long as it has. I mean, we're coming up on 30 years now, but I was sort of settling into the role and things were starting to really take off. And then, of course, the world shut down and it was all about keeping the magazine alive, as, you know, sadly, we know a lot of other sci-fi publications they lost their print aspect or they paused for a very long time. So, but we thundered through, but it meant it's very different in terms of what we were covering, because obviously TV and film weren't really being made or in very different ways, or you couldn't do set visits or you couldn't.
I was going to say,
We weren't doing interviews in person anymore. They were on Zoom and things like that. So, but you know, we persevere.
Yeah, I mean, weirdly, I found with that time, obviously, it closed down a lot of things, but it also opened up a lot of talent that we, you know, that might have been harder to get hold of because they were sat at home, bored out of their minds.
Yes.
So even on our little podcast, we got like Lance Henriksen and people that we wouldn't have got anywhere near on some amateur podcast. So you must have benefited from that side of things with getting to chat with the great and the good over Zoom.
Yeah,
as we're doing now.
Everyone says it was a very strange time, but there were lots of other opportunities opened up, and it did change the way that we do a lot of things now. It's just, you know, the office culture obviously is very different. SFX is a strange thing anyway, because I'm in London, my colleagues are in Bristol. And then there's an office in Bath. So it's a bit all over the place. So, we weren't really together because we talk all day, every day about nonsense. we don't really meet as often. So it was it wasn't too strange that I didn't see them in person as much, because I would see them maybe once a month, which is probably enough for them too, to be honest. But it's strange. I mean, obviously it affected lots of different people in different ways, but and certainly by no means least the fact that film and television was completely created differently, or indeed not created at all. So let's forget the dark times, let's move on.
It's very strange times. It has changed everything for good and bad. But yeah, It's weird to actually live through a historical period.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think the problem with magazines during that time, though, was people weren't able to get out to buy them. We were trying to encourage people to subscribe, which I obviously, you know, I still very much stand behind, because it is cheaper, it is more convenient, it's better for us, you know, to show our worth.
A link in the show notes, listeners.
because obviously travel shut down, then that was where the majority of people picking up magazines was in travel stations and whatever, travel experiences. It's been complicated, because obviously newsstand has suffered, you know, magazines and papers they haven't really recovered as much as we'd hoped in terms of sales since COVID. They're still good, but they're not as good as they were before COVID. I mean, I was quite impressed when I joined SFX that I was able to sort of for a very brief period before COVID to slightly increase the sales of SFX again. And that was always the intention, but of course, COVID just took the wind out of everything. But you know, we persevere, we adapt, we regenerate, and we move on. I mean, I'm just forever grateful that there's one small part of that whole situation in history that SFX is still with us, and we're still going strong. So
I mean, it's testament to you and to SFX, the people that came before, in a way, because it's such a strong brand. I mean, I remember when I first wrote for it, when Richard Edwards was, I think, editor or caretaker editor, whatever his official role was, because I used to work for him for Hot Dog all those years ago. But it's just, it's the sort of thing people who like sci-fi get thrilled if they get covered in it, or I got thrilled that I got to write for it. I remember interviewing Debbie Moon over Wolfblood, and she just had a one page in SFX, because Wolfblood had been picked up by Disney, which is the first BBC, CBBC thing to get onto Disney. And of all that amazing stuff, she was so thrilled and absolutely gushing that she got to be in SFX. And she was just like, you know, this magazine she's been reading since it started, and she gets to be in it for a page. And just there'll be millions of examples of people being, I can't believe I'm in SFX. So it's just it's just been part of the fandom, so many fandoms furniture over the years. It's a marvelous magazine, not least because it's often runs quite a lot of cutaway things, for which we're eternally grateful.
I mean, I love what Cutaway does. It speaks to me as a person who really, I mean, I'm absolutely obsessed with the creation of publications, print publications, and so as a fan, the fact that we have that, there's a quality product, because you know sometimes these things happen and they're not quality products. I'm not naming any names. We enjoy them to various different degrees, but you know, yeah, I mean, obviously, and also I love comics as well. So, you know, that's been a through line my entire life. It's kind of ticking all the bases for me, you know. I mean, personally speaking, I feel, and this is not just blowing smoke, but a lot of the time the Cutaway output is certainly superior to much of the various comics I've seen over the years that have been officially released. But anyway, that's just my personal opinion.
Of course, again, mentioning no names. yes. Well, this brings us sort of neatly onto the reason we're here today. The show that is Doctor Who, a crazy, stupid, silly show that bonds us all. So this is the story. You've probably answered this question before. I've certainly asked it of people before. But how did Doctor Who come to infect your life and take it over? And how much has it taken it over? How balanced a human being are you?
I always remember a quote from, I think it was Colin Baker in one of the documentary things. Maybe it was for the 30th. I mean, God, definitely showing my age. But he said, you know, I can go several days without thinking about Doctor Who. And I thought that was very funny, but I also thought, yeah, that's true, because I'm a huge fan of it, and it is a huge part of my life, definitely for the better. But for the most part, I could quite easily go quite often not thinking about it. Of course, that's now completely out the window because it is actually now on a professional level. I have to think about talk to you every day, which is no bad thing. But I think when I first, my first memory of Doctor Who is Full Circle. It was the Marshmen coming out of the water in Full Circle,
Oh, wow.
which is probably pretty terrifying for a, I must say, very, very, very young kid. And I don't know, like my parents, well, my mother in particular was very supportive in terms of if me and my brothers, I've got two younger brothers, if we were into something like Doctor Who or Star Wars or whatever, then of course it made sense that they would just encourage that. So I think I found myself as a sort of mini fan quite early on, but I don't think I crossed over into proper fan gene until probably like I didn't start recording it off the telly until season 24. I don't know whether that means you've crossed the line of something. I don't know whether that was because I didn't have video equipment or whatever, because I remember having a video of the Five Doctors off the telly, but I think it was Betamax.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, younger listeners can Google that to find out what that is. So, but we didn't really have, like, I wasn't, yeah, I don't know why it didn't really cross my mind. Well, probably because I was a child. It didn't really cross my mind to record this stuff. But by the time McCoy had come along, I mean, don't get me wrong, like, I definitely had all the books and the magazines and, proper, like, things like, the Peter Haining books and all of that stuff. And I, had whatever merchandise there was at the time, which wasn't that much. But I think something sort of clicked within me by season 25. Maybe it was the fact that it was being built up to be this anniversary thing, and I suddenly was like, oh, I should actually. But also there's a sort of level of allowing yourself, I feel, to go, okay, it is actually okay to wholeheartedly throw yourself into the love and appreciation of something, whether it's Doctor Who, whether it's football, or there's all these different things. Like, some things are sort of more socially acceptable, and certainly Doctor Who was never a cool thing when I was a kid, and that's fine, I didn't care. And it certainly isn't like it is now, where well, case in point, when SFX started in 95, it wasn't like that genre stuff, whatever you want to call it, like sci-fi, fantasy, horror, it wasn't cool. So it wasn't cool to like Star Trek or Doctor Who, or and then the X-Files and Buffy kind of came along and changed things. But certainly now we're at a point in 2023 where all of this genre stuff is so incredibly mainstream that it's gone beyond being a sort of the geek or the nerd genre, or indeed those things are now perceived to be cool. Whereas I certainly wasn't cool for being a Doctor Who fan at school, but I never really cared about that because it served me quite well, if you think about it, really, in my life. So yes, very long answer to a short question, but that was my first memory of Doctor Who is Full Circle, and then obviously watched it religiously through until, as we're now calling it, the wilderness years, but by which point I was fully embracing, new adventures, missing adventures, fanzines, conventions, all of that stuff.
Because I remember you saying McCoy was your favorite doctor, if you had to pick one.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, definitely. I mean, particularly those last two seasons, I think, are incredible, and I think they really, it was an indication of how different it was going. And it was a shame. I still think it's a shame that it wasn't as successful by that point, or it was tainted by politics and.
That last season was brilliant, and 1990, the season we never got,
Oh,
would have
yes.
been interesting to see. But bringing it onto your first choice, well, I put it as your first choice because it's McCoy and it's McCoy's first episode, and you, because of you, I had to watch Time and the Rani for the first time since transmission. I'm a little bit older than you, I suspect, and so I was a tricky teenager who'd been humiliated by Colin Baker years, and by the time McCoy came along, I was just like, kill it now, and I even remember being glad when it got cancelled,
You
which
rocker, you
I
absolute.
know, but which now I now go, I was an idiot. But teenagers are idiots. But I must say, Time the Rani, it has a really, let's say, bad reputation, but it's actually really good. I don't know what people are going on about. It just it really does become fashionable to just go, that's the worst one ever.
It's a word of mouth.
And it's actually really good. And Sylvester McCoy hits the ground running as the Doctor, as they all do. I watched Castrovalva the other day, which is another one you're not supposed to like. And Peter Davison hits the ground running with as the Doctor. He is the Doctor straight away. They all are. And we never learn, do we? That they're the Doctor straight away.
I don't hold with the you're not supposed to like. I think that's nonsense. I think if you like.
Oh, I know, of course. But
yeah,
you know,
I think if
I mean.
You like a thing, you like a thing. Yeah. I just don't. Yeah, you just. It's just a case of, you know, if someone says, "Oh, I love Time and the Rani," and then somebody else says, "Oh, I hate it," you go, "Okay, that's cool." But then what you don't want is that person to be like trying to push their opinion, going, "No, you must hate it. This is the reason." It's like. We're all allowed to have different opinions.
Oh, I know, I know. I mean,
the bottom line, it is just a television program, you know.
It is, and a very silly one as well. That's for a family audience. But it's, you know, but we love it. But yeah, no, I agree. I'm, you know, but there is a sort of prevailing attitude, and there are certain fans who are treat Doctor Who like a religion. We at Cutaway refer to some fans as the Taliban, because we are very much. What will the Taliban think of this? You know, knowing that we're going to get stick from the very extreme quarters.
I think when you're creating something, anything, you know, whether it's, you know, if you want to create art. So even when they're creating Doctor Who as the flagship of this thing that everything else is kind of revolving around, you know, including this podcast. There's always going to be an element of people that don't necessarily like what you have created, but you just don't think about that. It's not, you just have to do the best that you can and with what you have and make it from a place of love and appreciation and that will bring people to you. So, but you're never going to please everybody all of the time. So you shouldn't do that because you will drive yourself batty.
And I do think when they do start worrying about the fans, that's when not just Doctor Who, but lots of shows start to disappear up their own fundament. Listening to those loudest voices is possibly the worst thing you can do.
Well, certainly.
Because
certainly,
those people's opinions are usually the worst.
Well, yes, certainly in magazines over the years, I've been privy to publishers sort of above, you know, obviously the buck stops with them because they create. And thankfully, we don't have that at Future. You know, they realise that Future has all Future, who publishes SFX, they have all of these different brands which are across everything. I mean, it's just incredible how many different brands they have, but they trust in all of the teams that know that product. So they trust in the fact that SFX, we know and we love exactly what we're doing and we get it and we understand it. So they don't meddle with it. But certainly in previous places where I've been, I've seen publishers go listening to people's online opinions. And they said, oh, we have to change everything because, you know, so-and-so 47 on Twitter says this is terrible. And that person's never going to buy your product. But then as a result, fundamentally, you're changing the core of what your brand is. And, you know, sometimes those as a result of those things, the brands don't survive. So I don't think you should listen to, certainly, you know, constructive criticism is absolutely fine. But I don't think that you would immediately have to go, oh, well, this person online has given their opinion. You know, we've all got opinions, but we don't need to.
I can only speak for Cutaway, but oh my God, we do not. we do exactly what we want to do based within the parameters we've got. And, you know, confident and solid enough to believe in our own creative decisions, which is what you've got to be, isn't it? But I think when it comes to Time and the Rani, there's so many things I didn't appreciate as the callow teenager sulking because the show I really liked didn't have Tom Baker in it anymore. Basically never got over it for many years. But I didn't appreciate McCoy because I hadn't even got used to, hadn't really quite got used to Peter Davison yet by the time McCoy came along. So I didn't appreciate McCoy. I didn't appreciate Bonnie Langford, who's absolutely marvellous, but at the time I was part of the, she's that screaming person who's in musical theatre and things. And I really didn't appreciate how amazing Kate O'Mara is. And she's just phenomenal, isn't she?
She didn't like that. Well, she didn't say she didn't like it. She preferred Mark of the Rani. She was surprised when I said to her that that was my favourite. And she was like, she said, really? I think she preferred the fact that sort of Mark of the Rani was more sort of traditional, historical, proper BBC production, whereas, you know, Time in the Rani was a bit, it's quite camp, and it is a bit glitzy and spacey.
She gets to be in a wood in some historical locations in Time in the Rani. She gets to be in studio and quarry for Time in the Rani, rather.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I think there's a lot, like you said, there's a lot to it. A new Doctor, and effectively kind of almost a new companion, because unless, you know, you've only really seen Mel. I mean, I know that she was in like two stories technically prior, but it's one of those things where it's just a reboot again. It's a refresh. And like you say, it hits the ground running, quite literally running, because everyone's running around a quarry. For me, I am obviously attracted to the crazy campness of it all. And there's just so many reasons why it's just absolutely absurd, but they pull it off, you know. And the tetraps are incredible. Katamara is incredible. You know, the whole dressing up Katamara as Bonnie Langford is absolutely absurd, but it's fantastic.
Totally forgotten about that side of it. It's brilliant.
You know, and there's some great sort of TARDIS stuff in there as well, you know, the whole costume changing and all of that sort of stuff. And you know, Pip and Jane Baker, they just have some brilliant lines. You know, I just love it. It's absolutely absurd. The old idea of the Rani, you know, getting all these geniuses I mean, why shouldn't it be crazy? Why shouldn't it be absolutely absurd?
And that great big brain at the end.
Yeah.
That very much, it's weird because I didn't make the connection till I watched the Time in the Rani, but that made me think of the Russell T. Davis episode with the, well, you know, the era Russell T. Davis with the Ood brain and everything.
Yeah.
That very much made me think of that. But yeah, absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, the whole McCoy era, I've sort of only in the past few years have I really, really embraced it. Especially from sort of his second season to the cancellation. Absolutely brilliant. Because you know, when I heard Ace was coming back, I thought it's time that I really, really, and we had Sophie Aldred in as a guest, I was like, it's time I really, really sat down and watched all of the Ace years. Mm-hmm. I watched Dragonfire to the end, and it's absolutely brilliant run, really is.
Yeah,
and I'd never appreciated it before. I mean, that's one of the great things about Doctor Who and this podcast is I get to be, you know, forced to watch stuff that I haven't watched. And realize I've been wrong all these years.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright, Susan. Susan's in the road.
A meeting on the common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there! Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere!
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk.
Your second choice is another McCoy, one I have watched a lot, especially not just because it's one that we have done and are doing more of in Cutaway, but the Happiness Patrol.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I remember liking this at the time. That's how good it was. So the fact that now I'm no longer a teenager, it's one of the best of classic Who, I would say, for my money. Absolutely brilliant. I take it you like it too, because it's on your list.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think I would say that the Happiness Patrol is actually my favorite Doctor Who story. And I think it only gets better with age. As with all, with many rather of the classic Doctor Who things, and also possibly even, you know, the new stuff now, because it has been, 15, 20 years. Sometimes there are elements of things that we we know that let something down slightly. And but I think what so there are points within Happiness Patrol that are, you think, oh, it would have just been incredible if that had been a little bit better. Like, you know, the magma creature in magma monster or a magma creature? Anyway, that in Androzani, you know, you mm-hmm. kind of that's the thing that kind of slightly lets it down. But mm-hmm. But other than that, it's near perfect. But so with Happiness Patrol, you know, you just because of the limitations, I guess, you know, you've got the pipe people or whatever. But I don't know that. It struck a chord to me as a child, and it was only as I got older and watched it more, because as I said, that was the first season that I had recorded off the telly to watch, and so I did watch them quite a lot. And also, this is so nerdy, but I would also, I had an audio,
you're in a safe space, don't worry.
I had audio recordings of them so that I could listen to them when I couldn't watch the videos at home. so I know them very, very well. And I think what a lot of went over my head as a child resonates stronger still each time as an adult, because there are so many things in it that make more sense now. You know, but also because you can take elements of it and associate it with things that you know in your life. Like, I interviewed Graham Curry, the writer, obviously before he sadly passed, and he was fascinated to hear that it had become associated with LGBTQ plus themes, because obviously when I was at that time I was editing Gay Times magazine. They brought out the Ace box set on DVD, and as a fan, I would always try and get Doctor Who into any magazine I was writing for. Which, you know, side note, has served me very well, because that's now why I have this career. But so I interviewed Graham about that, and he, I guess his thing was the Thatcher element, which again now makes more sense to me as an adult and understanding politics, whereas as a child I didn't necessarily get it. So there's all those different elements, you know, the discussion of depression and also the grief. And things that, you know, as a child, you're kind of protected from, hopefully, in the best places. But as an adult, the Happiness Patrol really, really resonates with me on so many levels. And to the point now where I actually would probably find it quite difficult to watch, because it would trigger, I don't want to use buzzwords of modern living, but it would be a trigger warning for me, because I know that it's going, elements within it would upset me now. That's not that it's not a bad thing because of that. That's just a personal experience of it. I think the performances are incredible. I think the Candyman is absolutely fantastic. The nonsense of people saying that that's a bad thing, I think it's incredible what they did, and also very cheeky that they got away with it. You know, they managed to get away with it, but that nobody thought at the time, oh, we probably shouldn't do this because it looked a bit too much like something else.
It just looks insane. It just looks insane.
But I just think it's just a wonderful turn, the whole thing. There's a darkness to it that it's almost like, you know, you've had your classic Dalek adventure and now you're going into this new territory, and you just think, this is different. You know, it's, and I think that was the first indication of where McCoy stuff was going to go, and just how brilliant it could be. Yeah, the music's incredible. You know, this, the notion of the myth now that it was supposed to be filmed in black and white, and which of course it wasn't, but of course now we've got there's going to be a Blu-ray at some point, presumably. You know, there's other existing footage around. You know, they could present it in black and white as well. You know, there's new ways.
Don't they paint the TARDIS pink though?
Pardon?
Don't they paint the TARDIS pink?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, I was going to say that doesn't suggest they wanted to film it in black and white.
Well, then, exactly.
Unless they just keep the pink, that would be amazing.
That would have, yeah, exactly. You know, that's another great. That's a special effect they could do. They could have it all in black and white, but just have the TARDIS pink. You know, there could be a character options. TARDIS pink with McCoy action figure.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, you know, the fact I love. You know, I mean, obviously. Again, I know I've said this before, but what Cutaway has done with that universe is just wonderful. There's so much more in there that I just think, you know, all the things like this, the little comic strips, the backup strips and the stuff that we had in SFX, Oh, loved it. Loved, 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 loved.
Oh, it really it's I mean, this is a line Gareth always uses when we're on panels and things, but what's amazing about Doctor Who, and the thing, I guess Big Finish do the same thing as well, and we're sort of tapping in, is every just about every Doctor Who episode, bar a few, is like a pilot episode for an entire universe. And that's why it burns writers out, because that level of creativity, you go, oh, I'm going to come up with something that could probably fuel a series, but just for one adventure. And that's just amazing. And Happiness Patrol, same as with Paradise Tower, same with so other many things. They are such rich universes that we only see for like four episodes of Doctor Who. And I mean, then we've just scratched the surface, because obviously we've had the strips that are in the back of Paradise Towers and you printed in SFX. But what's coming next is Steve Lyons scripting, and Adrian Salmon doing the art, sort of full adventures. Not just the 2 pages, which I've checked with Gareth, I can say that. So if you've not
Well,
heard.
obviously, I will be very much pushing that through the SFX account.
Amazing.
As
Yeah, no,
but
it's so exciting.
I love that. I just there's something about it that it's funny when you're a kid, I guess, into all of these things and you're sort of your pew pew and all that kind of stuff. You're like, oh yeah, Daleks, Cybermen, whatever, and then. But as you get older, you start to appreciate different things and you start to understand things more. And I think that was the one for me is the one that I take so much more from it. And each time I watch it, I understand something different or I can apply something different to it. And it's very, very, very clever. And yeah, it's in many ways, it was sort of like one of the first things I think that was that lends itself to what are we calling it, new who.
Yeah, you can see you can see that kind of thing in, I guess, Gridlock and all that. I guess because it's a sort of feedback loop from Cartmel was very much everyone read 2000 AD, read Alan Moore, and that fed into Paradise Towers and probably Happiness Patrol a bit. So that sort of fun, action packed, but satire, so sort of Orwell, but for a family audience kind of vibe, and then that sort of feeds back into, Russell sort of tapping again into 2000 AD and all that sort of stuff when he brought the show back, and also the classic shows sort of take on that as well. So it's that's why it's so rich. All of it's so rich. I mean, Paradise Towers is a similar Happiness Patrol and Paradise Towers is kind of really good sort of bedfellows for me. They were both an indication that, like you said, that the show was back and meant business, and this was and I think Happiness Patrol is even more successful than Paradise Towers. They both sort of just grow and grow. Their reputation just grows as time passes, I would say. Out now from Cutaway Comics, part two of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form, set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time, for I am Sutek, destroyer, sworn enemy of all creation. And creation has many defenders, but this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutak. Sutak, hear me.
Next, this.
Yes, O brother husband, let my voice guide you back to me and home to Nanticoketat.
The land of the dead, and yet for me. It means life, a reprieve, and for the first time in millennia, a body.
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know, I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane. Even I, my love, wished death upon you. Only now...
You need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk. Sadly, we now come to the point in recounting Who's history. After McCoy, when the cancellation came, how gutted were you when... As I said, I would just remember going, good, so stupid anyway.
Oh, no, I was very
but,
much...
But are you distraught?
Oh, I wrote letters to the BBC complaining. I didn't understand it. You know, I didn't have the knowledge that I do now of how these things work. And I just, as far as I was concerned, it just always been on television. So I didn't understand why or how it could finish. Or do you know what I mean? I didn't understand budgets and ratings and all of that nonsense. You know, but as Doctor Who fans, we do, bizarrely, we do grow up and suddenly we have this weird encyclopedic knowledge of all of those things, whether we like it or not. I don't know. It suddenly just clicks on one day. Yeah,
What was scheduled opposite and all the different
shows? All of that kind of stuff. Well, I think you'll find it went up against Roseanne that night, and it was so very much distraught by the cancellation of it. And again, of course, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have, you just had to take face value what was in a newspaper, which of course, as we now know, is absolute rubbish. So for the most part, I just didn't understand it. But I do think, you know, as much as I say, oh, it's terrible, it shouldn't have happened, everything does happen for a reason. And I don't want to be all kind of cosmic cuckoo about stuff, but I do. But everything pays into something else, and you don't know the payoff until, you know, it could be days, years, decades later. You go, oh, okay. Yeah. If that hadn't happened then, we wouldn't be doing this now. And we wouldn't have the Doctor Who that we have now had that all not happened.
Russell T. Davies, when Michael Gray did his sort of History of TV radio series, I don't know if you heard that, but it's when they get to sort of 1980s, they have a bit on Doctor Who, and Russell T. Davies is there going, in a way, I kind of understand why you did it. And I'm kind of weirdly glad you did, because it went away and the wilderness years happened and all that creativity that happened anyway. And then the show came back and is bigger than ever. So maybe if it had sort of died a slow, slow death, then maybe it wouldn't have come back. Maybe we wouldn't have had half the amazing things we take for granted. But onto the wilderness years. You know, talking of fans doing it for fans, you have chosen Shakedown, Return of the Santarans, which, as I said in our emails, I have never seen before, and I watched it on YouTube last night. And again, it was, oh my God, it's good. I really enjoyed it. And those Santarans look amazing. The script's cool. Jan Chappell is actually, she's a cracking. I mean, I knew that anyway from Blake Seven, but she's cracking. And Brian Crouch. He's a lot more EastEnders than he is Travis. He's EastEnders persona, but absolutely brilliant. It's a cracking little thing. And I noticed Jason Haigh-Ellery's name is on the credits, and it's almost like, is this the sort of the first stirrings of the things that will become Big Finish and that sort of gigantic part of fandom that came out of the Wilderness years? So what's your relationship with this, with, you know, why is it one of your five?
Well, that was a time when I had really thrown myself into fandom. You know, I was going to Doctor Who local groups. We were going to conventions. You know, we were all devouring the unofficial fanzines and, again, pre-internet days. And, you know, we were just trying to any Doctor Who that we could get, you know, that was basically new. And so, as I understand it, and I'm sure somebody will correct me because that's what Doctor Who fans are very good at, it was, they were supposed to do a convention around Downtime, and that got put, Downtime got put back, which was, Downtime was the Yeti film. So they had to very quickly put together something else to premiere at this DWB or Dreamwatch convention. And so they did, they very quickly pulled together Shakedown, and they filmed it all on a boat. I think the boat's in London somewhere. I should probably go.
HMS Belfast. I've been there as a child, and I'm actually about to go there with my other child. I didn't realise till this that it's also in Got a Doctor Who Connect.
The fact that it was pulled together so quickly, because I think Downtime then happened the following year, and that was at more of an official convention. I think there was a DWAS convention that happened at. And it was, it just, for me, it's tied with a lot of memories of being with friends, you know, Doctor Who, other Doctor Who fans, and just going to London and having this ridiculous convention experience. And they basically, on the Saturday night at the convention, they had an auction where they sold off everything from the film, you know, like signs and props and all. And I've still got Carol Ann Ford's catsuit from that film. That's in my cupboard, which when I was much, much younger and slightly...
I was going to say, does it fit?
Well, it did. I used to go out clubbing in it, so it's not exactly in my cupboard. Yeah.
We want to see pictures of that, if you don't mind.
Well, every so often I do get those pictures out on Twitter. I mean, that's not the sole reason why I love Shakedown. I thought the production on it was great. I thought the music was great, you know, even though it does really homage Alien.
One of my big notes was this.
Yeah. You know, the scripts are great, the Sontarans are great, the script, the cast. And of course, then they retrofitted it into Doctor Who world by putting it into a new adventure. I think they put that in the middle, so the Doctor was on the either side of the story. But then, you know, now that became an official BBC book when they reprinted it many, many years ago. So it's this weird thing that it's kind of gone full circle. And to me, I find it really weird that it's not available on DVD or anything, you know, because it did come out on video. I do have a copy signed by the entire cast still. And there was a making of video as well, you know, and there was a lot of other stuff, but we did a little piece on it recently in SFX, and it was me going, oh my god, I love Shakedown. But it was very hard to get any imagery for it, because they're not lost to time. They still exist, but they're just not in high quality formats anymore. So, you know, I remember being at the convention and they were selling, you know, 10x8 glossy photos, so there's imagery. I love the fact that I'm getting so nerdy about Shakedown. Because everything, as a Doctor Who fan, it is about preserving as well, isn't it, really? I'm dodging the word hoarding, but we are so aware of things.
And obsessing.
So it is about preserving this thing and making sure that there's a record of it all and somewhere along the line. Like, but I think, like you say, it's very interesting to me that it is a sort of an early version, if you will, of what could be possible with the Big Finish universe or Cutaway or things like that, because people were trying to do something within the confines of, you know, what was not treading on the BBC's toes too much. But there were other things, like I think BBV were doing stuff.
Yeah.
But this was, I think this time was the first one where it felt like it was slightly up a notch, and it kind of set the bench for how things could and should go. And obviously it's very easy to do that in audio and to a degree comics, because you're not, the budget's not so bad. But yeah, it's difficult to do. I mean, sci-fi is expensive, as we know, and it dates very quickly, and you know, you're held up against other things, which is why Doctor Who's always struggled before the more recent version. But I thought Shakedown did particularly well. So yeah, there's something about it that I just It's a comfort thing for me. I can, again, it's something that I quote, I can quote it because I've watched it so many times. But again, it was during the wilderness years. We were thinking, you know, it's a new thing. It's in within the universe, although we didn't know at that time how it would eventually be retrofitted into the actual Doctor Who universe. It was nice to have something like that. It's interesting, actually, that you know, the food for thought that you've given me there about, you know, Jason's involvement in that and how this might have shaped things in a certain way. It's interesting, you know, how these things all play into each other.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the whole the Big Finish story. I mean, I'm now a Big Finish writer, although it's not coming out for a long time. 2025, I've been told, so I can't say anything about it. But yeah, but I just absolutely love Big Finish, and that was something I latched onto in my own wilderness years experience. But yeah, it was the Wild West back then. Like the fact that they were, the BBC kind of didn't mind that they were doing it, and then they called them in and said, and just gave them the license and then just let them get on with it. It mm-hmm. just seems crazy looking back. I know Disney are now going, you did what? With all this lovely IP, you did what? But it's just an amazing thing. It was fans making it for the fans. And I guess that ethos is in Cutaway as well. Not breaking any rules, paying the creators, but just Doctor Who can be so much more than just that one TV show, as I think it's probably going to expand more under Russell, but we'll talk about that later.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters, Issue 1, Fausti, written by Stephen Gallagher with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, written by Ian Winterton with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega, El Tralla, by Mark Griffiths with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
So you did suggest one of your choices being maybe the TV movie, but I'll let you talk about it now regardless, and you can talk about your other choice as well. But what was it like when it came back in 96 for you? What was your relationship with McGann and the TV movie?
I mean, it was just incredible because we all thought this is the beginning of it coming back. Again, that mentality of not really thinking about something having to be a rating success or a commercial success, because from my point of view and fandom's point of view, we just thought, oh, finally, someone's thought this is going to be a thing. And, you know, again, because I was attending conventions, I got to see Philip Segal and hear him talking about it. He was bringing things to, I think it was Monopticon in Manchester, and he was bringing imagery, and he played the theme for the first time to a room mm-hmm. full of fans. And I remember I was there with Neil Corey, and Neil Corey had recorded it on a dictaphone, and we were all in the bar listening back to it going, oh my God, this is incredible. and just, again, the excitement and the friendship group that I've been fortunate enough to have had all these years since, being in the wilderness years, the excitement for the return of Doctor Who and seeing it become a thing in Radio Times, and there being a TV movie special magazine, and the books, the script book, the video, the midnight openings for HMB, the little metal badges that you got free when you bought the video cassette, the rumors that there was a longer version because there was scenes that were cut, blah, there's so much stuff, you know, the excitement of that is brilliant. Just talking about it even now, I just think, oh, wow. What a great time. But we just didn't have any concept it wouldn't therefore continue, because you just kind of think, oh, well, they've built all this. Why would they not just do it? But again, if they had continued it, we wouldn't have what we have now. So
No. We also wouldn't have, like, I would say, I love Big Finish, but I'd say possibly their best of all the great stuff they do is the McGann right. years. That's the strand of Big Finish I never miss an episode of. I always, you know, since the beginning, I've followed the Eighth Doctor sort of religiously on audio, and it's brilliant and continues to be brilliant for my money. But yeah, but it wasn't to be on the TV, as he said in an interview. I think I might be the George Lazenby of Doctor Who, and so it was in a way. Although George Lazenby with thousands of hours of audio James Bond to
soften the blow, several return visits, albeit, you know, little versions, but you know, when he did Night of the Doctor, you know, I audibly shrieked when I saw that, because I didn't know, you know, I didn't know.
No, I didn't.
There was just that sort of split second of, oh my God, this is going to be a different, and then bang, and I was just like, oh my God, it's Paul McGann.
I must have watched that about 10 times on a loop. Just when it came, when it hit, I was just happened to be in the house. I was like, what? And just, oh, it's just, it's one of the most magical fan times ever.
I do have the TV movie as a very, even the fact that it just elevated it, I felt, you know, was great. And people might say, oh, well, it's this, and it's not really, it's a bit too American, or, you know, he kissed his companion, and well, that aged well. But it's, I think that it's just, it was just a great time. Again, you know, we had this little bit in between the wilderness years that there was something new that we all got to slightly obsess about, and whether or not we liked it or not is a different thing. Then maybe it wasn't the same as it was, but it was a, I feel now it's very much a bridge between the two versions that we didn't, we didn't know it at the time, but that was where it was going to sort of kind of go. And yeah, I think it's, I love it. I, you know, I love Daphne Ashbrook. In fact, you know, all the cast in that, I think, are great. The score, I love John Debney's score. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it fills me with, it's not just the nostalgia of, the thing about Doctor Who is it's never just about the, for me, the episodes. It's about the people that I've met along the way that are part of my life, that have sort of shaped the way things have gone. And that's, I can always sort of associate people and times and places with certain things. So, you know, the TV movie was just a great time to be a fan, I guess. And just hanging out with my friends, watching it, and also getting to show people this new thing and saying, oh, it's going to be on telly and you must watch it and it's going to be big. And there was an excitement about it again, you know, after, what was it, 8 years or something, or maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, it felt like an eternity because I'd become an adult, a proper adult, and suddenly it was back and I was, found myself going, oh, I'm quite excited. And I quite liked it, and then got disappointed all over again. But it's all just part of the history that's led to now anyway. But it's again, like with lots of these things, it's aged really well, because it is so modern. And I don't know if it's just humans in general, but Doctor Who fans as a mass seem to be very conservative and don't like change, which is just so ironic, because you're watching a show that thrives on change, that's constantly changing.
It's very true.
Oh dear, no. Well, this really isn't good enough. Suffering satellites, I've travelled across time and space to face you, and now that I'm here, nothing. Aren't you even going to threaten to exterminate me, you know, with your ray gun sticks? Come along, can't you poke your eye stalks out of issue 6 of Warp Warp? That's issue 6 of Warp Warp, the acclaimed Doctor Who fanzine, to present me with a bit of daring do? Some excitement, for pity's sake? I guess I can't blame them. I mean, it does celebrate 60 years of an unearthly child with a new interview with Carol Ann Ford, graphic reconstructions of the sets from Doctor Who's very first story, an extensive interview with Mark Gatiss about an adventure in space and time, plus Clive Doig, Brian Hodgson, comic strips, and oh, so much more. Heaven knows how they fit it all in. Do you know, I might take a look myself. Oh, yes. Yes, most exciting. All this plus a free disc containing, among other treats, a dynamic 18-minute animation of the much-loved alternative opening to Doctor Who, as told to David Whittaker in his classic 1964 novelisation, Doctor Who in an Exciting Adventure with the Daleks. Oh, I'm sorry. You see, we're all now too engrossed in this super new issue. There'll be no excitements from me or these tin terrors today. No deadly exterminations. Well, you know what they say. Warp Warp and no sleigh. Purchase your copy from warpwarp.co.uk now.
So, time of recording, we're in the week 20 years ago when it was announced for the first time officially that Doctor Who was coming back under Russell T. Davis. Now, were you a journo at the time? Did you get to go, oh my God, I'm going to get to cover the shit out of this? Because I know I did.
Years ago, 2002?
Three. 2003, yeah.
No, this is me dodging around. I went to university in 2004, so as a mature student. So I was excited about it, but also I think I was taking it with a pinch of salt. I was still getting that kind of information from Doctor Who magazine, and I was always very aware of the cover splashes they had to say, Doctor Who's coming back, and this was for the Dark Dimension. And then within about two issues, it was no, it's not. So I was optimistic, and I loved Russell's work. I mean, I've been a huge fan of Queer as Folk, a life changing thing for many people, I think, that show. I certainly didn't, when it was announced, I didn't think that I would have any involvement. It didn't even cross my mind. I just thought, great, brilliant, it's coming back. This guy is clearly amazing, and that's going to be great if it does happen. And I just had no concept of how it was going to once again make such an impact on my life. It's actually crazy now to think about it, but
I know, it's so weird. It's like I had no concept when it came back that it would become a huge, as big as it did, and that it would kind of reinvigorate this love I already had and make it huge, and now it's gradually taking over my life.
Well, yes, exactly.
Ever more. But then I've had three children, and it's impossible to imagine that having those without Doctor Who being on TV. And it's just so many things. It's like embedded in our lives. Just, it's glorious. It's glorious.
The good point that you mentioned there is that nobody had any concept that it was actually going to be A, good, or B, successful. And I think the fact that it became this absolute juggernaut, you know, it was that sort of 2005 2006 era where you could walk into shops and there would be huge displays, and we were like, what's going on? This is not,
I kept joking I was actually on, like, I was like, you know, like Sam Tyler from Life on Mars. Actually, I was in a coma because this was obviously not real. This was just my Doctor Who fan having an imagination while being in a coma, because it just seems so surreal.
Yeah, we didn't have any concept that it would have a life beyond just being a show. We were kind of almost kind of like just being very thankful, going, oh, thanks for bringing it back, you know, we're lovely, thank you, we'll keep it to ourselves, thank you. And it went beyond that. But also, like you say, it changed the landscape for so many things, because it did. It meant that, you know, then we got Merlin and Three Musketeers, and they were trying to, and Primeval, and there was all of this stuff, you know.
And Atlantis.
Yeah, Atlantis. There was, you know, for every low, you know. But it changed things, and, you know, merchandising, magazines, books. Oh, gosh. It was just incredible. And what was fascinating to me is there was never a plan. It was never like, right, we're going to do this and we're going to take over, which is what a lot of things are trying to do now. Not Doctor Who, but other studios go, okay, we have this franchise, this IP, and it's very much about doing it and it not being particularly from a loving place, whereas Doctor Who was just brought back because people loved it and fought passionately to bring it back.
Well, like all these things, it was a fan making it. Yeah. Not just for the fans, but a fan who, you know, I don't think there's anyone in this country that's got a better idea of television than Russell T. Davis.
They never had an expectation of, okay, we're going to make this a franchise, we're going to make it merchandise, we're going to do all of these things. And I think it probably surprised them as much as anybody else. But
I know it did, yeah. But I mean, where I was positioned, because I was a, you know, a freelance entertainment journalist, the buzz hit immediately from 2003, and when there started to be events, I very quickly found out that it was, I kind of got the impression it was going to be bigger than we maybe thought, because I remember going to various editors going, well, you know, Doctor Who's coming back. I don't know if you're interested, but I, you know, I'm a Doctor Who fan. I'd quite like to cover it. No, the editor's doing that. The editor's a huge fan. And you realized everyone was a fan and they just hadn't talked about it. But most of the coverage was taken by the editor. And you can tell when they really like something, because they don't give it to a freelancer somebody on staff. They do it themselves. And they're like, oh, well, I'm afraid the editor will be going to the press conference. It's his first press conference he's been to in many years, but he's did not too much. There seems to be two things to me that are at the heart of so many creative people's thing. One of them is Doctor Who, and the other one is Dungeons and Dragons and role playing games. They seem to be the sort of the DNA in so many of us. Mm-hmm. We were the lovely geeks at school, and now we rule the planet.
I've often said that Doctor Who is the reason I have the career that I have now, is because that opened the door for me because of this, because I had this knowledge of Doctor Who, like I say, encyclopedic. and then this new version came along, and it was like everyone wanted to a piece of it, and everyone wanted to write about it. I was then able, and I was at university, and I was able then to do freelance stuff while I was at university. And while I was there, I got a job as it was a freelance job, and it was for the Pink Paper, which at that time was the longest running LGBT newspaper in the country. And they gave me a job as the Scotland correspondent, because obviously that's where I was living and where I was studying. And I would put so much Doctor Who into whatever I was doing, because I thought, oh great, now I can finally use this. And it's the current cool thing. So then people started doing personal appearances. So John Barrowman came to somewhere near Falkirk. His family had, they had a store specializing in nightclub equipment. And for some reason, John was coming there to do an appearance. So I said, oh, I pitched to my editor, oh, do you want an interview? And that I sort of pushed my way into making my role bigger by interviewing people who were in Doctor Who, because that was my sort of in. And at that time, the paper wasn't really excelling in doing interviews as much as it could do. And I was like, okay, well, Elizabeth Sladen's going to do this spin-off and blah, blah, blah. So then slowly but surely, I made the role bigger. And then they offered me a job as features editor, so that when I graduated, I moved to London to take that role. And then I ended up working across the other magazines in that particular publishing company and all of that. Like when they did Torchwood, Children of Earth, I had interviews in like four or five different publications all tying together for that. So there was a lot going on, and it was all through Doctor Who. And then of course, down the line, cut 10 years later, the stuff that I was doing across these titles, which was because of Doctor Who, was basically what got me in the door at SFX.
And a marvellous job you're doing. To get onto your last two choices are both New Who. So we have School Reunion, which I just remember loving, because that was that like the first time properly that the classic series really got referenced, with Jane and K-9. It was absolutely glorious time to be alive. For my money. It's on your list, so
who'd have thought?
Why School Reunion?
Just beautiful. Just a great, just the fact that it was almost changing the direction of what this new thing was going to be. And it was heartbreaking, and it made it feel so much more human, just the giving these people, they've come and gone for the last, 30 odd years or whatever. And we've always just accepted that as Doctor Who fans. But actually, there's a consequence to their lives with the Doctor, and what happens afterwards, and what it means. And again, there's a through line, I think, especially in New Who, of grief and loss. And as we all get a bit older, we understand that a bit more. And I think aside from just the joy of seeing Sarah and K-9 back again, it's understanding the repercussions of what it means to be in the Doctor's life, which of course Russell then went on to explore quite a lot more, as we got towards the end of season four and everything. But just wonderful to see Elizabeth Sladen back, and I worked quite a lot with Liz throughout the remainder of her career, and that was a joy. But just as a fan, just wonderful, and just that I just loved it. Beautiful, that ending. But we didn't know, like, of course, there was going to be any life beyond that, and it went on. Thank goodness there was so much more to come. But that ending where she insists on making him say goodbye, and just heartbreaking. I loved it. That final scene where they walk away. Wow, I mean, just. Yeah. Beautiful.
I've watched that episode a lot again because I've got three children, and every one of them goes through the Doctor Who phase. And I always say this, but I think it's testament to the Russell T. Davies era that they could choose anything they, you know, they've got all the Who available to them, but it's watching from Rose up to the end of Tennant that they just, that's what they, you know, they dip into everything else, but that's the bit that is the solid, that to them is Doctor Who. So weirdly, you know, one of them's 15 and one of them's 8, all of them would say Eccleston Tennant is their doctor.
Yeah.
Are their doctors, which is a, you know, which is a weird thing, because usually we like the doctor we're given as an 8 year old. That tends to be the rule, isn't it?
It's all though, isn't it? It's not about linear anymore. It's people discover things, and you know, and things happen on Twitter or TikTok or whatever, and suddenly something becomes new again, and people have, and it just, things have new lives, and it's not as straightforward, I guess, as we used to experience Doctor Who. And what I thought was the strangest thing about school reunion is the fact that, you know, however many years later, 30, I don't know if it was 30 or 40 years later, canine toys in the shops. Incredible. Who'd have thought it? Just incredible.
Mad.
So funny, but brilliant. And, you know, I have a remote control canine. Fantastic. Who'd have ever thought, you know? And not just a specialist toy, actually in every toy shop in the land. What a joy.
But yes, the school reunion, and obviously you're a Buffy fan, I'm assuming you are, just because you seem a man of taste and distinction. Buffy, I love Buffy so much. Anthony, and I think Buffy is an essential part of the DNA of the new series as well. It's there with the Rift, it's there in Torchwood, it's there in the 45-minute, you know, the way it tells, the way it has a arc in a series. It's, you know, Buffy changed TV, and just a few years later we got Doctor Who, or a decade later, didn't we? We got new Doctor Who infused with it. But you're having Anthony Head there as the main, what are they called, Krillotanes, aren't they? The main Krillotane buddy is just another little amazing thing about that brilliant episode.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
So, your last choice, because we're having the TV movie as an unofficial choice, but your last choice is almost, in some ways, the sort of opposite end of the RTD scale, because School Reunion is its plot and everything is very child-friendly. It's one that you can show kids early on, and Waters of Mars is at the other end of it, in my experience, in that it's scary as hell. And that's the one I've had to turn off most when children are screaming and I'm getting told off by my wife, because it's a very grown-up piece that has a suicide at the end of it. It's one of my favourites as well. So Waters of Mars, Darren Scott.
Dark, isn't it? It's so dark. I mean, I love it. I was at the press launch for that, and the episode finished and Russell kind of clapped his hands and went, right, any questions? And then there was this kind of audible gasp from somebody, and they were like, can we just get a minute, please? And because everyone was like, wow. And I suppose it's funny, because I presume they'd have sat through that several times, you know, in edits and what have you, in preparation for getting it ready for a press launch. But this is the first time the press were seeing it, and we were just like, whoa, that is a lot, really heavy. I thought Lindsay Duncan was phenomenal in that episode, and again, that absolute, the desperation in it, the fact you know that no one's going to survive, you know that it's just bleak, and it's such a brave choice to do that. And I think at one point there was talk about it being a Christmas special. Can you imagine?
That's why, because it's got snow at the end as well, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So I was like, why is it snowing? That looks Christmassy. But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, just really, really scary. And I love my horror. And I think one thing that I'd love to see current Doctor Who do is kind of up the stakes a bit, like, you know, the sort of classic Tom Baker stuff. I'd like to see a bit more of that.
When its most memorable moments of New Who are when it has horror elements, like The Empty Child, Blink, Waters of Mars, when it does have those scary, you know, kids love being scared. Absolutely love it.
But yeah, just the, again, I get, it's that classic sort of base under siege Doctor Who story, but with a really hopeless situation, a really, really a feeling that this is not going to go well, and realizing that that is a life situation. And but also just the intensity of Adelaide's realization at the end of the impact of it all and what she has to do and how that's done. I mean, I just was absolutely gobsmacked when I saw that, and not in the sense that I was offended or felt that it went too far or anything like that at all. It was just, I just thought it was incredible storytelling.
Yeah. And I think it shows how like assured Russell was that, and also that God, compared to the classic show being abused at every level by the BBC, the fact that Russell was able to just go, I'm going to have a suicide at the end of this family program. You don't mind, do you? In fact, I'm not asking permission. Yeah, that's what the movie demands. It's amazing. I get
the impression he doesn't ask for permission.
No. He other people make things happen. is the impression that I get. He's a and why wouldn't you? Because he very rarely puts a foot wrong, that man. But I always think it's kind of the New Who horror of Fang Rock.
Yes.
You know, base under siege, everybody dies horribly, but with the added twist that we're told everyone dies at the beginning. So you assume the Doctor's going to subvert that and get away with it. And that looks like what that's going to do. And then it's like a double switch because no, she kills herself. Just amazing. I really love that era of the specials as well, because I didn't, maybe as a child it would be different, but as an adult, it felt like there was enough Doctor Who. And when it did appear, it was brilliant. Mm-hmm. So I was quite happy with that. I think that's why the Planet of the Dead isn't as fondly remembered when it's actually really decent, because it was a special. Whereas if it had just been in a run, it would be, oh, this is really good.
Yeah.
But I think because it was like that year's Doctor Who, it's not got as many bells and whistles as the others. I mean, I just thought Waters of Mars just... Have you read the script? Because it's available on BBC Writers' Room. It's a brilliant script as well.
Oh, I should have a look at that. No, I haven't.
Yeah, really. I always remember this because it's sort of got fires coming out of his ass when it describes how fast the robot's moving.
Oh, really?
Fires burning from his ass. it's like in the script, is in the action description.
The specials from that year, the other one, of course, that I love from that year, just very briefly, is Next Doctor, because that's also that's for Christmas Day. That is dark. It's a dark.
Yeah, yeah. No.
He's been abused, and she's just gone absolutely. She's just gone maniacal with it. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
She would go to, and the evilness, and just the fact, you know, some of the lines in that special. Again, I was like, wow, this is going out on Christmas Day, and a lot of it would go over people's heads, but just again, phenomenal.
Yeah. And that's what makes New Who so good is it really leans into the emotion. When it leans into the emotion and they go, like you were saying about, you know, about Sarah Jane, it starts to go, well, this is the actual, these are real people. They're not just ciphers. They're not just, you know, there's no marrying Leela off with 5 minutes of meeting a guy.
Yes.
They do the opposite. They're like, well, actually, how would this affect a human being? Yes. And it's there from the off, like, you know, when you rewatch The End of the World, second episode of New Who, and they've got Rose going, 4 billion years, I've been dead 4 billion years. So it has that darkness, like right from the off, like in its DNA. And as we were sort of saying, that comes from the maturing of Doctor Who during the wilderness years, new adventures and all that sort of stuff. But then bringing it back, you know, into it, but still making it family friendly, but with that darkness shot through it. And I think that is Doctor Who. It always was Doctor Who at its best, quite dark and quite grown up, but for the family. Anyway, it's been amazing hearing your choices, Darren, but it's time for us to go. And I look forward to seeing you probably at the next BFI event in due course, or speaking to you about future cutaway things, the stuff that's coming for the 60th is particularly exciting cutaway wise. But that's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you.
No, thank you. And I look forward to whatever is coming next from Cutaway.
Lots of stuff. Cool. We'll cut there.